It was like a drink of water after being in the desert. I literally started to weep. My shoulders dropped down and I was totally hooked.
Welcome to the Sleep Junkies podcast. My name's Jeff Mann and we cover the whole conversation on sleep. So, as well as looking at the latest sleep science and research, we also like to look at cultural trends which pertain to sleep. And one of the biggest trends in recent years in the areas of health and well-being is the topic of mindfulness. Now, mindfulness can mean lots of different things to different people, depending on your perspective. But essentially, modern mindfulness is a secular version of some of the thoughts and beliefs and practices that originate in ancient Buddhism. And in the past few decades, these practices have been increasingly adopted by Western culture, and now we're seeing big companies using mindfulness as a tool to improve productivity in the workplace. We're seeing mindfulness being used in schools and in politics. We're seeing mindfulness being used by many, many well-being companies to improve relaxation, reduce anxiety, and of course, to help with issues to do with sleep. So we're going to take a little bit of a deep dive exploring mindfulness. Exactly what is mindfulness? What is the research behind mindfulness? How it can specifically help with sleep issues? And also we're going to take a little look at some of the critiques of mindfulness and the commercialization of it. And we're talking to someone who has been in this sphere for a long time, has been through structured training to do with mindfulness, has an appreciation of the place of mindfulness within other therapeutic practices such as CBT and psychotherapy, and also holistic well-being practices like yoga and meditation. So we had a really interesting conversation. If you're liking the podcast, don't forget to subscribe, leave us a review on iTunes. You can also check us out on social, on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and of course on the website sleepjunkies.com. That's it for the introduction. On with the show. Good afternoon. I'm sitting here on a very sunny April afternoon overlooking the Thames. And I'm sitting here with Hope Bastine. And we're here today to talk all about mindfulness and how that applies to sleep. So, hi Hope, and really great to see you on such a lovely day.
No, it is a beautiful day. It's actually the perfect location for it as well. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure, pleasure. So you run a well-being brand and a company called Fresh Perception.
Yeah.
Essentially, your background is in teaching and education. You studied psychology and neuroscience. You're doing your PhD now in human flourishing. Maybe you can explain a bit more about that. You're a psychotherapist, you're a yoga trainer, you're a CBT practitioner.
Yeah, it's a bit eclectic.
Yeah, you talk to companies and brands as well and how they can integrate mindfulness practice into corporate cultures. But also you do a lot of work around sleep as well, yeah. Which is the reason I was interested in getting you on the podcast.
Yeah, it's a journey. And I think when I look back, all roads led here. As you pointed out, I have done lots of different trainings in different places to bring together a very holistic approach to the way we are in this world. And even though I gave up teaching, those skills and that degree, what that taught me, and you know, if you can hold down the attention of your 9 pubescent boys, I think you can hold down anyone's attention.
Yeah. So were you actively teaching meditation and yoga at that time, and you just kind of fused the two together, or is that how it happened?
Yeah, actually the reason why I did the yoga training was to develop my own personal skill and experience. I was getting frustrated because I was going to, weekly classes, and I didn't feel like I was growing and progressing, and doing a teacher training course felt like it was the next stage to that. But also because in the mindfulness course, there is a module that is the movement module.
Right.
And Jon Kabat-Zinn highly recommends that you are qualified in a movement-based practice if you're going to be teaching that module. So I'm really interested in making sure that as well-being practitioners, we are well qualified in doing whatever it is that we do. But also, I'm curious about experiences and learning and growing. And, you know, we cannot just be mind-focused, we cannot just be body-focused, and we cannot be just spirit-focused. It is an integration of all three.
Okay, so I want to ask probably an unanswerable question. You know, it's still highly debated about this term mindfulness, exactly what it is. And different people, depending on where they're coming from, academia or research, or they're coming from medicine, or they're coming from, you know, holistic medicine, it seems everyone's got their own different take about what mindfulness is. My understanding is that mindfulness is based in an ancient practice, an ancient Buddhist practice. And where we are now, we have a secular version of that. You mentioned Jon Kabat-Zinn, who's kind of formalized that and introduced that into clinical practice. That was in the 1970s?
Yes.
And since that time, it's kind of exploded, isn't it? The last 5 or 10 years. And now mindfulness is everywhere, from technology, apps, coloring books, food, everything. You know, people are appending, you know, this term mindful onto it.
Yeah.
And I'd like to explore that a bit later. But would you be able to answer this unanswerable question?
Okay.
What is mindfulness?
Okay, so I just want to sort of start with one of the points that you raise. It everybody seems to have their own definition for it. And I believe that the reason that is that it touches us in different ways, each one of us. It those of us who meet mindfulness. And it is what it is to us. And we are and the practice is very grounded in our own personal experience. And actually, you know, back in the day, the very ancient practice, you weren't actually supposed to talk about your experience. You weren't supposed to share it because it would dilute somebody else's. It's a very intimate personal practice. So I wonder if the reason why it's so hard for us to find a universal definition for it is because we are so unique and we all find experience in so many different ways. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that when I teach mindfulness and meditation, I actually like to separate the two words. They have become synonymous and they're not.
Yep.
Mindfulness or mindful is the psychological quality, and meditation is the practice that gets you to there. So what experts are agreeing on is that it is the state of being aware. It is the acknowledgement of our sensory-based experiences and bringing us back down out of our head and back into our body. There is the openness to experience aspect of it. There's the aspect of pulling back from putting things into a like and dislike box. So we say non-judgmental, but we very quickly stereotype things, or we very quickly appraise things, and we already put it in a box and therefore we dismiss it. But what we're doing, and we're doing that, is that we are bridling the ability to find out something new. Then there's the very, very important aspect of compassion and kindness for yourself. So those are sort of the themes that come up.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely right. In science, when we're trying to research it, we can't research it unless we agree on a definition. That's like the 101. What's also really interesting is that one of the reasons why I think it's exploded is that in the 60s and 70s, we saw the New Age movement.
Yeah.
And all the great neuroscientists that we know now, almost all of them went to India on their gap year, their trip of enlightenment.
Yeah.
And they discovered this practice, came back to MIT, came back to Stanford, came back to Harvard, and they all went to their professors and say, oh, I want to do my PhD on this in neuroscience. And everybody was like, you are not going to make your career there, because it was just too new and too out there.
Yeah.
But those same people maintained practice.
Right.
And they have built up their career enough so that now they can step out and go, okay, now we're going to research this.
Yeah. it's very important to have a very defined definition of what mindfulness is.
Yeah.
But this distinction between mindfulness and meditation, that's a tricky one in terms of trying to explain to people.
This is very much grounded in Buddhism. And if we look at the story of the Buddha, he went off on a journey to seek enlightenment. And there are about six types of meditation. And he went through every single one. And towards the end, he goes, everyone has their value, but they're still missing something. So you've got transcendental, you've got Vedic, and they're all great and useful. But they need something else in order to take you further in terms of the deeper personal growth. And that's what the Buddha brought to the table, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the really interesting things is that, okay, so a lot of people talk about mantras. And what the Buddha says is that, okay, yeah, mantras are great for settling the mind. But if that's all you're doing, it becomes an external focus, and the point is to draw your attention inward and to look, cultivate your inner landscape. So there are, he brought in several layers to the practice, and actually in the progress of your growth, mindfulness is one of the layers. And Jon Kabat-Zinn, he himself said, I just picked a word out of the text.
Right.
It's like, I don't know what to call it. What are we going to call this? Right. Well, actually, we can relate to the word mindful.
Yeah.
We know that it means being present or being aware. And the Sanskrit term, satipatthana, means remembering to remember. So it's the continuous art of coming back, being present, just like you and me right now. We're paying attention to what we're doing. Our mind isn't elsewhere. We're focused on this present moment.
Yeah.
And that is pretty much the very definition of the origin of the word.
Right, great. We've nailed it down. Okay, so we've mentioned Jon Kabat-Zinn, Dr. Jon Kabat-Zinn. Is it fair to say he is kind of the guy who brought mindfulness?
We would call him the father of modern mindfulness.
The father of modern mindfulness, okay. And there are courses you can do. You can go to university and do graduate studies in mindfulness now. There are some qualifications, MBSR, MBCT.
Yeah.
So there is a formal structure for
there,
all this.
There is a formal structure, and I think for the Western mind, that works really well, that you have these stages. So it's an 8-week course. In the US, it's the MBSR, so mindfulness-based stress reduction.
Right.
In the UK, it turned into mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, and then it's changed to cognitive training.
Right.
Because it's not actually therapy, but it is therapeutic.
Yeah.
And that's what's also a really important distinction. And for the Western mind, this very specific structure works. But it's important to note that this is an intensive and is an introduction.
Yeah.
So if you were to go off to India or to an ashram, or, you know, you would actually do this over a very long period of time, this course. So at least we get a taste of the different techniques, the different themes. And sometimes when I teach this, somebody gets sort of not stuck, but there's one that's just their one. And that's where they need to be. They need to stick to that practice and go through the growth of that.
So these courses, these formalized courses, are they for clinicians, for trainers, or can normal people do these courses as well?
So, I mean, anyone can do the course. If you are trained to be a teacher, that's a different discussion altogether. Mm. And it is formalized, it is being accredited, it is grounded in the clinical practice, because let's face it, you still are dealing with people's mental health, and you're dealing with people's stress. So it is important that if you are looking for a teacher, that you do your research and make sure they are appropriately qualified, get references, etc. I've had some people come to me where someone who wasn't the least bit qualified taught them, and they were suffering from PTSD.
Right.
And the way that you would do meditation with somebody with trauma is extremely different to the standard course.
Right. So can you talk a little bit about how, you know, how that happened, how this mindfulness got translated into clinical practice? People may be unaware that there's quite a lot of research that's been done as well in this area.
And there are research centers now set up specifically to investigate this from a neuroscience perspective as well, which is really incredible. How it came into this course, how it came into our life was, John Kabat-Zinn was a professor, he was a researcher in genetics, so he was very much grounded in hard sciences. Okay. And he had contacts at Massachusetts Hospital where the clinicians were saying, okay, we've got these people who are just in phenomenal pain. We've done everything that we can with them. You know, is there something that you can do with them? And they gave him some space in the hospital, and he constructed the course, which is based on, you know, years of practice. Obviously, it was fine-tuned, and you learn and grow through it. But what they did find, and then he obviously, you need a course, you need a structure in order to be able to measure it and to test it. And it did help mitigate people's pain. And one of the key ways that we solve our distresses in life is through acceptance. And when we watch the process of acceptance in someone's brain, so again, the magic of fMRI, we can see something has happened. We don't know exactly how that process is working, but we can see that the resistance is softening, and it changes our relationship to whatever it is that we're resisting. And obviously, when we're in pain is the perfect example of that, where we're feeling this point of discomfort, and then we build up all this resistance around it, and that actually exacerbates our pain.
I'm thinking there's this big Venn diagram, you know, mindfulness and meditation and yoga, CBT, psychotherapy. You describe mindfulness as a lifestyle, but you could also kind of look at these as of tools as well.
Yeah.
So how would you sort of marry that up? CBT is very, you know, it's about action points, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's very, very focused, but mindfulness and meditation, let's say, it's a different kind of thing to that, isn't it? But they're all related.
You know, one of the sort of the key teachings that mindfulness has to offer is to bring you back to the present, to shift from the doing mode, the goal, the focus on the goal, back to the being in the present, enjoying being here right now in this conversation, and not focusing on the end result of this conversation. I think, from my experience, that has some fantastic therapeutic qualities. People will come to see a therapist, they have their 1 hour a week, and sometimes they just sort of walk away and forget about it. But if you're applying some tools that they can take away with them, then the therapy, the intervention, encompasses their lives, and people feel like they have something that they can walk away with that's really important.
Yeah.
So yes, it is a tool. It's a very powerful tool.
Yeah.
And it meets you wherever you are.
I want to ask you a bit later some of the critiques of mindfulness. There are some viewpoints that it's, you know, it's cultural misappropriation of something coming from the East to the West.
That is cultural evolution.
Yeah.
We learn, we grow, we have new science, we have new insights. Everything grows and shifts and evolves.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's made its way over to the West means that we're able to apply some of the Western tools to it.
Yeah.
But the problem is that in our desire to sort of stick to the authentic, we're actually resisting change, which is actually exactly counterintuitive to the mindful way, just be open to the experience in front of you.
Yeah.
But also, we cannot ignore that we have a Western mind, we have a Western body. Sitting cross-legged on the floor is not suited to our body types.
Yeah.
It's extraordinarily painful, and it causes harm.
Yeah.
And that is, again, counterintuitive to the yogic way.
Yeah.
And what's also really interesting is that in the West, we've separated, again, this is a side effect of the Western mind, separated yoga and meditation. But in the East, it's one.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You do the yoga, you exhaust the body so that you can sit and focus and cultivate your inner landscape and your spiritual growth.
Yeah.
But you can't do that if your body's restless.
Yeah.
What's really important to be clear about is that, you know, the West has tools too. We have science. So, for example, a physiotherapist will tell you that sitting for 3 hours a day is really, really harmful to your body. You shouldn't be sitting for more than about 45 minutes. Your body, certainly every hour, you need to move your body. So there still needs to be balance somewhere between.
We talked about it earlier before we were recording, but this idea of the beginner's mind and curiosity as you, you know. You...
And not come at things with your own agenda. Yeah. So one way that this tool has been incredibly useful in the corporate world, for example, settling the mind. If people come to a meeting, the team meeting, mindful, aware, present, rather than what some people will come with a set agenda and not be hearing and listening to the other points of view. We all walk away feeling hurt, misunderstood, and which contributes to our dissatisfaction and happiness and unrest. So a lot of companies actually will start off the meeting just taking a mindful moment together. And so that there's this more beautiful open communication going on.
We'll talk about some of the specific strategies, but I guess what we're talking about is ways to get into that situation of, you know, self-awareness, mindfulness. Let's just stick to the term mindfulness. You do talks and you train people, and I guess you train individuals and groups.
What seems to be happening is that people say to me, they'll come to me and go, I started the course on an app, but I kind of lost my momentum, I lost my way.
I saw some statistic, there was like over 1300 meditation and mindfulness apps on the App Store, so it's all over the place, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I wanted to do one for a while, and you know, there were some people that were interested in backing, and then we did the research on it, and it was like, well, it felt like it was a little bit saturated now. But they are useful tools. But again, when you're relying on it, that's not the aim of mindfulness and meditation. And aim is a very bad word in mindfulness. it's not the point. But also, it's about community. It's about shared experience. I mean, one of the reasons why the practice of secular or modern mindfulness has shifted somewhat in the UK is because actually we're really isolated. We're not comfortable talking about our sensory-based experience. So when we have the group talk to tease out curiosity and experience, and it's about bringing people together. And that community, that is basically the very definition of yoga, is really, really healing, and it is what the Western world needs.
Well, we're
an individualistic-based society.
Yeah, we've kind of designed a society which is based more focused around an individual, but we're not going to get into politics today, but, but it kind of, you know, it touches.
But mindfulness is entering politics. We have, you know, the Mindfulness Initiative in Parliament right now, which are making huge changes in applying mindfulness in schools and in mental health, and it's really beneficial. But also we've got, you know, Tim Ryan, who is one of the greatest advocates in the States, who's, wow, what would that be like if we had a mindful president?
Never happened before.
So it is better to start off taking a course or maybe an introduction. And I always offer people the opportunity to use an app to support their daily practice. But at least once a week, even after you've done the course, find a community, find a place to connect. Because what's also really interesting, and this is what David Lynch discovered when he actually started doing some research behind transcendental meditation, is that the brainwave pattern, the alpha brainwave pattern, is amplified when four or more people are together in the same room. So a lot of people say, oh yeah, I find it really difficult to do it on my own. But for some reason, it's easier when I'm in a group.
So I just wanted to get that point across, that similar to like CBT, for instance, many different entry points into it, you know, if you just want to do it on an app.
It comes to you in different ways. And it came to me personally in my life through my sleep problems. So I was actually studying a diploma in hypnotherapy, and the course teacher had his wife suddenly had the baby and got a cover teacher in, and actually that cover teacher was a specialist in mindfulness, That's how I discovered, and we sort of discuss his applications to sleep, and that's how I discovered, and when I practiced it then. And it, what's really funny is that I grew up in India. I've been around yoga, and, and I turned my back on the whole New Age way, and then next thing I know, it's found me, and it was like, for me, it was like a drink of water after being in the desert. I literally started to weep when my shoulders dropped down, and I found some stillness, and I was totally hooked. And what was more powerful to me than anything else was that I grew up in a pretty strong religious background, and you know, you have that oppression of being told what to do, how to think, who you should be, etc., which we all suffer from in society. But what mindfulness and meditation has to offer you is that the answer comes within. You find your authenticity, you find your own voice, you connect with your sense of right and wrong, the moral reason. Everything that you need is within you. You just have to be willing to look and connect with it.
We haven't really mentioned, but it's pretty much across the board, the range of conditions and the types of things you can use mindfulness for.
You would shift it a little bit. For example, for somebody suffering with PTSD and trauma, you would never immerse them in a deep, long meditation. They would just be drowning in their own trauma. So it's little and often. It's very short, 1 minute and 3 minutes, right. For example.
Right.
So you do, if you are interested in its clinical applications, you need to be very familiar with the clinical issues.
Yeah.
And it is, you know, John Kabat-Zinn says that it is not the panacea. It is not the answer to all. Unlike most religions, they'll say, you know, I am the way, the truth, and the life. That's not what mindfulness is.
Well, let's list some of the things. So obviously you need to see someone, a specialist who's trained in this, but you mentioned, you know, trauma, PTSD, depression.
It's fantastic for anxiety. It is really unhelpful if you are in a depressive episode and you're doing meditation. It is very effective when you're not in the depressive episode and then you go through the course, because when you do go through a depressive, you have the tools to apply. But just think about it. You're already down in the depths.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you're doing this calming technique.
Yeah.
Why would you want to do that when you're down there already? Because the idea is to get you back up to baseline.
Yeah, so there's very clear guidelines about when you shouldn't do this because you're not in the right state.
Yeah, you're not in the right state. And that is actually what being mindful is, being aware of my body. What does my body need right now? Am I overactive? Okay, then. And then there are different techniques for different things as well. So, you know, you would want maybe a body scan if you know, you're feeling too much physical pain and tension and you can't go to sleep. So that would be very effective.
Yeah.
Whereas a thought stopping technique, if somebody's very active and they're suffering from what I call busy bedhead syndrome, which is as soon as your head hits the pillow, suddenly your mind just explodes with the to-do list.
Yeah.
What's really effective for people with very active minds and anxiety is the counting the breaths. So they're still connecting with the sensory-based experience, but they're giving their mind something to do.
Well, let's go into this idea of mindfulness meeting sleep problems.
Yeah.
So what are the benefits? You do a program, isn't it? Like it's about an 8-week program as well.
Yeah, so it's a mindfulness-based sleep program.
So maybe it's useful to
go through that.
Yeah, to go through that and talk about the kind of the actual applications of using mindfulness and what kind of techniques that would involve. So
the way mindfulness can help us with our sleep problems, there are two ways. The first way is some really practical tools, as in the relaxation techniques to settle the body and mind. But in terms of the psychological quality of being mindful, being aware, listening to your body, what does my mind and body need right now, the self-care, that's extremely powerful in our sleep epidemic issues. Because we think that we can switch on and switch off in our life. And that's not how our mind and our body works. We need to gear up for the day and we need to wind down. And being aware of that, being aware of actually, well, why am I tossing and turning in my bed? Why am I wrestling the pillow? Oh, what is my body saying? My heart is beating really fast. My muscles are pumped. I've had too much coffee, you know? So why am I forcing myself to go to sleep when my body is screaming something else?
Well, as you say, as you mentioned, what did you call it? The busy head.
Busy bedhead syndrome.
Busy bedhead syndrome.
And one of the other sort of side effects for modern life is that we have technology that offers us this constant information stimuli. But our brain needs 1 hour a day before this invention to process the day. It just literally needs to sit down and do nothing, to look out the window, to watch the planes go by, to watch the water. Because our brain is constantly doing background processing.
We don't really do that, do we, in general?
And we don't do that. As soon as we have a moment, what do? Take out the phone.
Yeah, that's the default now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Maybe it used to be staring into space, but now it's staring into a screen, getting more input, isn't it? More stimulus.
And our inability to get to sleep from a lifestyle perspective, I'm not talking about clinical disorders, there are plenty of experts to do that. I'm talking about our lifestyle issues. Yeah. I think one of the reasons why that we have such a hard time getting to sleep is that we are have this backup of processing to do. And what meditation, as in giving you the stillness and space to process, is really effective for doing that, to providing that.
I like that analogy. For a lot of people who experience some problems, they go to sleep and they're still... they've yet to process all of this stuff that's happened in the day.
So one of my key interventions, and it's what I'm writing my book on, is the cultivating the pre-sleep ritual, carving out that 1 hour in your day, at least. I mean, we have busy lives, so it's pretty hard to do more than that. Where you are actively aware of what you're doing and you're actively mentally and physically preparing the mind and body for sleep. And our brain likes rituals. You know, there's been quite a lot of talk on rituals lately, you know, but rituals are extremely effective and they're not the same as routines and habits. A routine or a habit is mindless. And a ritual is aware of the intention. And when that happens, the brain brings the body into gear. So it activates the motivation pathways in the brain. So if you every time you're like, oh, well, you remind yourself of your intention and then you're back on.
Great distinction there. So pre-bedtime ritual as opposed to the pre-bedtime.
I prefer the term ritual,
If you say routine, often enough people just switch off,
really,
don't they?
Boring, I'm bored of habit. I'm bored of that.
But this idea of ritual, that puts a different spin on it, because then it becomes an active process.
And you're conscious, you're immersed in it. And also, it's probably the best time in the day to cultivate your me time, to have that space, that hour just for you.
So does this hour, does it need to happen pre-bedtime? Is that the only, is it fixed? Or if you, can you, right?
It needs to be fixed. Brain, language of the brain is repetition and routine. and so in the same way that you should be going to bed and waking up at the same time, having that ritual marking that preparation time is essential for preparing the physiology and the mental mindset for sleep.
So give us a picture what that would look like then.
So it should have at least three stages. The brain likes number three for some reason. We like these chunks. And I divide it into mind, body, soul, spirit, whatever you want to call it, mind, body, me. And it's, you can't look after the mind until you've settled the body. So do your personal hygiene, have your bath, have your magnesium salt bath, fantastic for softening the muscles. Even lathering yourself up with moisturizing cream or you can actually get some that's saturated in magnesium, which is really key for helping us sleep. The touch has a very powerful effect on releasing neurotransmitters that make us relax and help us, give us that nice well-being feeling. So it starts with the body, even if it's just sitting on the sofa, turning the lights low, so you're already shifting the environment to prepare it for winding down, sipping a nice cup of herbal tea, maybe some sleep tea. So it's body first, then it's mind.
So I'm guessing as well, all the usual sleep hygiene things that we think of.
I don't like to use that word sleep hygiene. It sounds very clinical. It's, you know, it's in the CBT literature, which is fine. It's very effective. The concept is fine. I don't like using those words because it feels very clinical. And clinical doesn't help us feel sleepy. We need warm and cozy. We need safety and comfort.
Oh, no, I don't like the term as well. And I think of these like the ground rules. A simple thing, you know, avoid stimulus.
Just think about the language that you just said that in. You focused on the don't. Our brain is attracted to the negative. Don't think of the pink elephant. What are you thinking about? Don't look at your phone. Oh my God. So I like to flip it to the positive. Okay. Here's what you do. You're applying the tools. Here's what to do. Turn down the lights. Banish blue. What is the music that makes you relax? What's your favorite read? What are the things that you like to do that make you feel relaxed? Connect with that.
Okay, so
so we've done body, we move to mind. So then we need to settle the mind, and that might be doing a meditation that helps to focus the mind. So it's counting the breath. So the one of the most effective breath meditations to help us sleep is Andrew Weil's 4-7-8 method. So, I mean, the rule of thumb is the exhale needs to be longer than the inhale to activate the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the rest and digest stage. So it's inhale for 4 seconds, hold your breath for 7, that's hard, and then exhale slowly for 8. When you're counting the breath like that, and it's activating relaxation experience in the body, it is a really effective, powerful tool. And a lot of people literally just turn over with that. But sometimes, again, using the mindful approach is like, well, maybe that's not what you need at that moment. Maybe you need to write a list. You know, you're going to bed and your head is still spinning. So we know that list writing in the evening, the to-do list, is really helpful for us to sort of get it out of our head, put it on paper. For me, I rehearse the next day. I plan it out in my head, and I'm really afraid of forgetting something that I need to do. So I actually find that really, really effective.
Yeah, no, me too. I tend to work quite late, you know, which is maybe I shouldn't confess that on the podcast.
No. But maybe that's your chronotype.
Yeah, that's my excuse.
Or maybe it's just practically it's the only time that you can.
Yeah, there's that as well. But I do that, you know, very often. Damn, it's late. So I'll just do a to-do list. And I find it really helps. By writing them down, you're sort of parking them as well. So
you're also letting it go.
Right.
And that's also a very lovely, mindful concept, the ability to let things go.
So you don't have to remember to remember in the morning. Because you've already jotted it down, so you can...
So it's you know. And then the last phase is... whatever you want to call it, the me phase, the spirit phase, the soul phase, what is it about giving yourself this space to cultivate your inner landscape, time to process? So it can be a different type of meditation, so an open monitoring meditation, a reflective type meditation.
Can you talk about that a bit? Open monitoring and focused attention and kind of my understanding that these are sort of opposite ends.
They are. If anybody has properly studied the process of meditation, they will tell you that the focused attention would be in the very early stage. So let's say you're going to carve out an hour. You would do some yoga, so stretch out the body, make the body supple so that it's ready to be still. then you would do a focused attention meditation. So that can be the counting of the breaths, or it can just be watching the sensory in-out kind of experience. Whatever it is that works for you, that helps you narrow your attention down to one point of focus. The very definition of meditation is one point of focus.
So this is picking maybe a mantra, a word, or something.
Absolutely. So that would be focused attention. Mm. Once you've settled the mind, and it will take about 6 to 7 minutes to get your brain used to doing something, to shifting gears. And then after that, you'll start getting the benefits of it. So the first 6, 7 minutes is like this sort of adjustment period. Yeah, and then the brain sort of gets into that groove, and it's like, okay, this is what we're doing now. And then open monitoring is an advanced practice, let's say that.
Yeah. You want to be like a radar, picking up on everything that's going on.
You want to be picking it up and letting it go. So you're just aware of it, but at the same time, you still need to stay grounded. Think of the metaphor of the tree. You've got the roots, you're grounded, you're sitting upright, you're processed to be aware, and then your radar is out there. But it's not out there to the extent that you lose your way. You go off into the clouds. You know, people talk about astral projection. If you lose your roots, you're not doing it right.
You know, some people explore these kind of things through, you know, psychedelics and all that, so it's not going off into the...
But that's a delusion, that's a distraction. If you're looking at the philosophy of mindfulness and meditation, that's basically ungrounded, that's a distraction. Right. The brain is extraordinarily good at coming up with distractions. It does not like doing nothing.
Right.
So we hallucinate. And if you push through the hallucination, then you find the pool of peace. And then you go through that because the peace is kind of a nice place. You kind of want to stay there.
Yeah.
But then you kind of got to be willing to go deeper to deal with your stuff, the layers of your stuff. And that really is about our existential angst, the real stuff that keeps us up at night. But also, the reason why I find that sort of me section of the ritual really important is that, you know, sleeping, we're not dead when we're sleeping. There's stuff happening in our inner landscape. We're dreaming, which is a way of processing, making sense, problem solving, is one of the leading series, is also crucial to our identity formation. And when you're opening up the space toward that, when you're aware of what's happening, you're setting the intention of cultivating who you are, cultivating your spiritual growth as well as your physical and mental growth.
So I guess having that space, this meditative space, you know, whether you're an advanced open monitor or you're a beginner, you're doing some focused attention sort of meditation, I guess what you're saying is when you eventually do fall asleep, all those processes that are going on, they're going to be assisted. You're going to be in a more open state to kind of process those effectively.
Yeah, this is an area to be further researched, but theoretically, you know, the nightmares that wake us up, the reoccurring dream, it could be our mental resistance to something that we're trying to figure out and process.
Yeah.
Whereas if we were softening our way to that, when we were preparing the pathway to figuring out what it is that's really keeping us up at night.
Fascinating, yeah. Makes loads of sense.
That's the theory behind my book.
Okay, a little sneak preview there. What's it called?
Meditate.
Great, okay. Heard it here first. Okay, try and get back to sleep now. So some of these techniques.
The other one is progressive relaxation.
Yeah, yeah.
So a lot of people spend their whole day in a very tensile mode. And we acclimate. We get used to having our shoulders hunched up.
Yeah.
And people tell me, I don't know if my leg is relaxed. I don't know if my arm is relaxed.
Yeah.
So that is a very useful way. It's a very useful technique for softening the muscles, relaxing the muscles. And we teach in a very simple way. Actively tense your body and then release.
Yeah.
The release is what relaxed is.
Yeah. Yeah. And you work through?
You work through systematically from, usually it's from the bottom up, but time.
And this is something you can do when you're in bed, you're just lying in bed. It's been shown that this is a very effective technique.
Very effective. And also one of the lead disruptors for sleep disturbance is discomfort in the guise of too much heat or too much pain. Let's just say you have an injury and we overprotect that injury, so we create the tension around the injury. And those muscles are tight and sore, and that causes us pain. Whereas if we used the body scan to systematically relax the muscles around that, then we release the buildup towards that pain, the tension around that pain.
Yeah. And often these kind of things are very interconnected, aren't they? And, and the way that we perceive pain, we might think I've got a pain in my hip, but it might be somewhere else. And
yeah, our body speaks our mind. It's a mystery in there. But whatever is happening in that body is a clue of what's going on in there. So if you're physically tight, if you're physically agitated, it's a sign that your mind is agitated.
Yeah. All of these techniques, let's say the mental techniques, and for want of a better word, and the physical techniques, this is all about this process of intentionally having an intention to just be aware that, of the processes that are going on.
Being aware of where you are, what's happening, is a very, very powerful tool, let's call it that. Because the moment that you name something, the moment that you label it, the moment that it comes to the forefront of your consciousness, is the moment that you're able to also let it go. And letting go is the first step towards acceptance.
Okay. I wanted to also talk about, you mentioned earlier that Jon Kabat-Zinn said this is not a panacea.
Yeah.
And because of the way the world works and mindfulness is such a big thing, loads of people have jumped on the bandwagon. There's been some critiques.
Yeah.
And also I think it's useful to mention them as well for people who may have sleep problems or may have other problems. But I just want to go over these briefly and get your take on them. So some people have made a critique of mindfulness in the sense that we're using a practice of mindfulness and meditation, let's say, without the ethical insights and the social framework around that. You know, what do you say when people bring those kind of topics up?
I think that they're very valuable. And, you know, the 8-week course is a prece. It's an introduction to the concepts. But it is, in the East, it is a tool and technique to grow personally. And in the structure of the 8-week course, it can be approached, it can be taught in a fairly superficial way, so that we're sort of sidestepping this quote-unquote spiritual qualities that it has to offer us. And that might be because that's just where people are in their personal growth. So sometimes it feels like it's, I don't like using the word dumbed down, but it's become very superficial.
Yeah. And I totally get it in a corporate environment because you don't want to be, people are very sensitive about religion and all that. And you want it to be accepted. It's a difficult thing, isn't it?
It's a tricky balance. When I speak and teach in corporate setting, it's very much grounded in the research, it's very much grounded in the science, and it's grounded in the practical applications and tools and techniques. If people want to cultivate another aspect of themselves outside of work mode, then they come to me and speak to me after, or I show them somewhere else that they can go for that.
I get it. If they want to embrace the value of mindfulness, it's problematic if they start shoving religion down people's so I can see where the difficulties are there. Also, this idea of mindfulness, it's funny, I was reading some articles, someone was talking about you could be a mindful hitman for the mafia.
You could
go about,
I don't know if that's true, because if somebody were to really practice the art of meditation and mindfulness, they would look within and they would connect with our inner morals, our inner sense of right and wrong, to somehow locked in our gut, we all know it, and if they actually were doing that, then they wouldn't be killing people.
Right. Maybe that's a bit too extreme an example.
But I read the same article. I was like, but I think they're just focusing on the word aware. instead of the broader umbrella of what it is.
Okay, so maybe bring it back to sleep again. So let's say someone had issues with their sleep.
Yeah.
And they had anxiety problems. And they thought, I'm going to try mindfulness. But really, in the big scheme of things, it turned out that the relationship was a bad relationship. And let's say it was, you know, a thought experiment.
Yeah.
It was screwed, the relationship.
Yeah.
They shouldn't be together at all.
Yeah.
Someone's thinking, right, I can fix my sleep problems with mindfulness.
But
really,
yeah.
Mindfulness is not going to tell someone, you know, go and get a divorce, is it? But I mean, so what is the role? What's the root?
That's a tricky one. I mean, the sort of really big, deep questions.
Hmm.
Sometimes it's the questions that we're not willing to consciously face, but it comes up in our sleep space. So yes, take the relationship, for example. But if you're coming at the mindfulness techniques in a superficial way, this is just going to fix my sleep, and not really engaging with the deeper practices of it, then yes, of course, it's not going to work. But if you are applying the techniques in a way of the Google term search inside yourself, you will probably discover that what's really keeping me up at night is this unrest I feel about being in the wrong place or being in this, you know, it's how you use it. And also, we need guidance. We need teachers, and those teachers are not, here's what you do. It's a support, let's show you, or let's figure it out together.
So this is the value, I guess, of seeing someone who's qualified and a trainer who will be able to give you a bit more guidance, you know, as opposed to doing something with a book or an app where you're kind of on your own.
Yeah.
So I guess what you're saying is if there were these bigger structural problems, another one, for instance, maybe you're doing it as part of work.
Yeah.
And then you realise that you hated your job.
Yeah.
And the best thing for you is to leave your job.
Absolutely.
So.
And I've worked with people that have actually figured that out through the course.
Right.
It was like actually the reason why I was so unhappy is I've been putting off my retirement or something like that.
Right. That's tricky though, isn't it? Let's say you're going into
a
corporation and then you give all this training, you know, but you see where I'm going with this.
Yes, I can. But also, this sort of polarized thinking is endemic of our society, and we want quick fixes. We also want universal truths, which is why we are having this problem of mindfulness mindfulness is the panacea or not the panacea, the answer.
Yeah.
You know, it's our tendency for black and white thinking or polarities.
Yeah.
Maybe you are unhappy at work, but instead of actually being a part of the cultural change, you just walk out, you leave.
Yeah, my viewpoint, forget about these, you know, Buddhist practices, but I cannot see a situation where it's not advantageous to be mindful or to be aware.
Absolutely, because it's a psychological state of being aware, being conscious beings. We are naturally conscious beings, and then somewhere along the way, we forget about how to do that. So again, this is the difference between the meditative practice, which is the technique to get you to be mindful. Mindful is some definition of us being human, capable of being aware, being conscious.
Yeah. You mentioned it earlier, this thing of mindfulness, I think was an article written a few years back doing another critique of the commercialization aspect. I mean, that's an issue as well, isn't it? People just jumping on the bandwagon and saying, oh, there was a drink, I think I saw that, you know.
The mindful drink.
Yeah.
I liked Mindful Bites when it came up. I thought it was a great idea. Where there's like a nice little quote, and it sort of says, okay, have this snack, but be aware of it.
Yeah.
And take this moment, this mini moment.
Yeah.
And that I thought was quite useful, and if it's used in that way, then it's great.
Yeah.
I don't know if we need separate products for it.
Yeah.
It's going a bit extreme, but it is the way of the commercial world. And then, of course, we would argue that, you know, are those people possessed by their greed, really being mindful?
Yeah, exactly. What's your motivation in doing this?
What's your intention?
What's your intention? Yeah. Yeah.
So many people discover meditation, ashrams, mindfulness, they go off on that and then go, oh, this has touched my life. So I'm going to go off and do that instead of actually just applying it into the real world and living consciously. So Buddha called it the middle way, which was, you know, extraordinarily powerful. We can't all live in an ashram and be monks because then we would go extinct. So, yeah, it's a huge discussion.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome, Hope. Thank you so much. Can you tell people a bit more about Fresh Perception, how they can find out more about what you're doing?
If they go onto freshperception.com, it's my website, you can get an idea of the types of workshops and interventions that I offer. It can be in a corporate setting and it can be one-to-one.
Yeah.
So reach out if anything speaks to you.
Yeah, and you have specific programs for
specific for
sleep, but also just for a different specific program for mindfulness as well, isn't it? And you're agnostic, you use mindfulness as a tool for lots of different situations.
So so there's the mindfulness based 8-week program specializing in sleep, so that's practically applied, and that's, you know, that is integrated with the CBT approach. You are thinking about the sleep environment, nutrition for sleep. It's a very holistic based approach. And then you've got the mindfulness course, which is for corporate environments, for mindfulness in the workplace. How do we create a conscious workplace?
Well, thank you so much again.
It's been pleasure.
Fascinating. Thanks, Hope.
You've been listening to the Sleep Junkies podcast. If you like this episode, don't forget to subscribe or check us out on social, on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, or on the website sleepjunkies.com. See you on the next one.